Benjamin Lohr was overweight and out of shape when he showed up at a Brooklyn Heights studio for his first Bikram yoga class. He immediately found himself hooked on the Bikram practice, in which students hold a series of 26 poses for 90 minutes in a room heated to over 105 degrees Fahrenheit. And before long, he was practicing for 6 hours or more a day. He went on to complete a grueling 9-week-long teacher training course and even signed up to compete in a professional yoga competition. He tells his story and delves into the mystery-shrouded origins and practice of Bikram yoga in his book, Hellbent: Obsession, Pain, and Search for Something Like Transcendence in Competitive Yoga. He was on the show last December. We are re-airing our conversation for you today. I began by noting that Mr. Lohr was only 29 years old when he attended that first class, and I asked him, how had you come to be overweight and out of shape?
Oh, I'd say the typical. Went through a bad breakup, kind of spent the rainy spring on the couch, you know, ordering food, just indulging in the process of fattening myself up.
Well, some people would go to a gym. Others might try other exercise programs, Pilates. There are lots of other yoga approaches available. Why did you choose Bikram?
I didn't choose it so much as I showed up. I was fat to the point where I thought, if I could just go into a regular exercise, I do my normal way of getting back in shape, of just going on some jogs, I'm going to hurt myself. I'm going to get shin splints. And so yoga attracted me. There was something about it, you know, it felt like fruit or vegetables. It's one of these things that's going to be good for you no matter what.
Because of the spiritual side as well?
Well, I don't know. I came in as a total novice, and in Brooklyn, everyone's walking around with yoga mats, and I thought, I got to try this out. So Bikram, the lineage, I had no expectations of it. I just showed up.
Well, in retrospect, might you have had the same result with Hatha, Ashtanga, or another type of yoga?
Well, Bikram is a form of Hatha yoga, and so I think you can get results with anything, and I think that's one of the points in the book that I'm clear about. I don't think there's anything magical about the Bikram series. I think there's something magical about dedicating yourself to a specific discipline, and putting in the time and the consistency and the practice. And Bikram offers some addictive qualities that may make it easier to fall into that discipline and that routine.
Addictive because so many endorphins are released?
Addictive because of the endorphin release. Addictive because of the sequence. You see improvement in your practice over a rapid period of time, and that feedback loop is attractive, and you notice your body changing. You know, you're standing in a classroom with a full-length mirror watching your body change from pudgy to progressively more toned, and it's gratifying. And so beyond any, like, cliched runner's high kind of experience at the end, there's a positive intellectual feedback.
I see Bikram yoga studios all over the city. Are classes taught the same way in all of them?
Yes, and that's one of the defining features of the yoga, good or bad, of Bikram yoga, is that it's a kind of a rigid 26 posture sequence. That's not only the posture sequence is rigidly defined, but the words the instructor's speaking. It's a dialogue from the guru, Bikram Chowdhury, this very living guy in Beverly Hills.
From Calcutta originally,
and a Hatha yoga master from a young age. He studied about age of three with an Indian yoga guru, and he was very clear that when he came to America and started getting American teachers, that he wanted them to teach his yoga in his particular way as taught to him by his guru. And the result of that is he didn't trust his teachers. He recorded himself teaching a class, wrote down the words, which are in his kind of Calcutta English kind of butchered grammar, and to this day, teachers just recite his dialogue.
Now, he said he was personally invited to move to the United States by Richard Nixon.
Yes.
I didn't know Nixon even practiced yoga, but you've written that his life story reads like that of a character from a Salman Rushdie novel. And there were several competing versions, aren't there?
Oh, well, I mean, he is... He's more hyper-real. If Salman Rushdie wrote him, we'd all be complaining that Salman Rushdie created a totally unbelievable character. He's an egotist, a narcissist, a healer. He, you know, whether Nixon invited him to this country or not, I think we can err on the side of not, having talked to several authorities in the Nixon Presidential Library. He's led a flamboyant life, fell in with the Hollywood elite in the 1970s almost immediately upon coming here, and... Uh,
And he's known for teaching in a Speedo. The best way to show off his body?
Yes, you know that, and there's something to respect about that. It's flamboyant, but this is the product I'm selling. He'll say, "I don't sell cheesecake. I'm selling this, and this is a toned man in a Speedo, on a at a peak physical condition, and I want to show that off."
Still, he's in his 60s now.
He's in his 60s. Is he in peak physical condition? He's in pretty good condition for a 60-year-old.
My guest is Benjamin Lohr, L-O-R-R. His book, Hellbent, Obsession, Pain, and the Search for Something Like Transcendence in Competitive Yoga. At first, Bikram offered his classes free of charge. Was that because he wanted to spread the word about yoga?
That's the tradition that he came from in India. Yoga is offered free of charge. And I think when he came to America, in his own words, he was relatively naive.
But he went to Beverly Hills.
He didn't come to
New York. He didn't move to Atlanta, Georgia.
He didn't. And so when he says he's relatively naive, it's hard to know what that means in terms of what level of self-presentation that is. It is clear that, by his own admission, he was a virgin when he arrived to the States. He didn't know much about American customs. He did know enough to gravitate towards the wealthiest subsector of America.
And movie stars.
And movie stars.
Famous athletes.
Famous athletes. The Los Angeles Lakers, at the time they're winning championships, are all bending in his room. Shirley MacLaine, Jeff Bridges. You could list the roster of the 1970s, 1980s elite in Hollywood, and they were all there kind of bowing towards him and gravitating towards him. He's this fantastically charismatic guy.
Did he show them any favoritism?
No. I think that's one of the things that Bikram does particularly well, is that he holds everyone at a distance and holds everyone to a standard. So you're kind of craving his attention, and you're craving this... craving any praise that he gives, because he gives it so sparingly. He really holds a standard, which is emblematic of his yoga sequence as a whole. The 26 postures, you're kind of chasing after perfection in these postures. And in doing so, you learn a lot about yourself on the internal side. I think there's something about pushing and trying to reach your maximum that teaches you, at the end of the day, humility. It teaches you compassion for yourself, because you can't get to 100% perfection at anything. And over the long term, trying to do that teaches you the opposite.
Well, he even ostracizes people who don't seem to have done anything wrong. So,
he can be a nasty.
It's holding people in their place.
Yes.
When did he start charging? When did that attitude change?
Well, his story is that Shirley MacLaine took him aside and was like, "You're an American now, boss. You got to act like an American. When in Rome, do like the Romans." All of these stories.
And she had lived as a Roman, so she would probably know.
Yes. All of these stories that I would take with 100% grain of salt. He's a savvy guy. I'm sure he realized he could make a lot more money teaching with payment.
But he then copyrighted the sequence of exercises that he developed. I wonder about that. Was he worried that other people would steal from him?
Well, again, you get this double-edged explanation. I think he would say he was very worried about control. He wanted to make sure that his yoga was being taught in the manner that he wanted it taught in. It goes right along with him, the words in his dialogue. However, the flip side of that is, that type of control is emblematic of the negative aspects of
him. He wound up suing Raquel Welch, one of his favorite students. And he sued many people since.
I mean, Raquel Welch made a beautiful workout video that was almost an identical copy of his yoga. And he felt like...
Did he win?
I think they settled out of court. He has a pretty poor record of winning these lawsuits. He tends to settle.
It's hard to copyright exercise movements because he didn't invent them anyway. But that's a whole other issue. One of the things that sets Bikram yoga apart from other yoga styles is that it's always practiced in a very hot room. Has he ever explained why those rooms are kept so hot?
Because
there are people in sports physiologists who say that that can be put a lot of stress on your heart.
Well, there's benefits to the heat for sure. I mean, it limbers the body up. It opens up blood vessels. There's an analgesic effect that reduces pain. So people coming into it in a kind of a rehab capacity can gravitate towards it. On the other hand, there are negative effects to the heat. You know, I think it does stress the body out. For me, I approach the heat as, and I think in America, it's become less about the medical benefits of the heat and more about the fact that it pushes you to a liminal place. And it pushes you to makes a sequence of postures that are difficult, extraordinarily difficult. And it makes that difficulty accessible to someone who might not be able to push themselves to that place otherwise. So a soccer mom comes into a Bikram yoga studio and she gets an experience that wasn't necessarily available to her. She gets an experience, you know, like climbing Mount Everest in a 1.5 hour class that is a, it produces this incredible feeling of accomplishment. And he's, you know, he kind of bottled this up for sale to the masses, where previously that type of liminal exercise might not have been available to everyone.
The 26 particular poses, which he says have to be done in a particular order, referred to as poses for beginners. And then you can go on. This is almost like Scientology. There are advanced poses. What you've called the backbend club.
Sure. You know, like as with anything, you can take it to the limit. And there are people who want to indulge it to its maximum. Again, I don't think it's quite – I would resist any overlaps to Scientology. To me,
no, I was just joking. No. Although there are occultish aspects to this. I mean, he started – he became – seems to have been become very much of a martinet, and he's been accused of having sex. I mean, he may have been a virgin when he arrived, but having sex with some of his followers, he seems to have been corrupted a bit into creating a cult-like situation.
You know, he fell in with the Hollywood elite. It's hard to imagine that not having an influence on who he became. It at the end of the day, the Bikram that exists out in my experiences with him and hearing the stories of the people is not a Bikram that I would want to be associated with. He's narcissistic. He's controlling. He seems like he's ruthless with people who've surrendered their lives to him. And part of that is probably his development, but part of that is it's the natural development of a leader who has had millions of followers surrender their sense of self to him and are willing to massage his ankles, massage his thighs, massage his shoulders, fetch him water, do all these things for him. I mean, who can imagine what that does to someone? It's hard to put yourself in that position. I think I'd probably be corrupted pretty
quickly. Well, you put yourself into the position of the backbend club. And there have been a lot of injuries, haven't there? There's a lot of pain. You say that because you were one of the few students with a car, you were repeatedly asked to drive classmates to chiropractic.
Injuries in the backbending world, I'd put in quotes. I don't know anyone who did the backbending club who would consider themselves having been injured.
However, did ribs pop out of place?
Yes. And so that's why I put it in quotes. Do I know people who've had dislocated ribs? Did I go through experience excruciating pain? Absolutely. I think it brings up these ideas of what pain is and what pain's relationship to injury is. I think dislocated ribs are obviously an extreme place. But backbending club does introduce you to pain in a kind of non-Cartesian sense. It allows you to explore pain as a sensation and really learn to recognize pain in the way we recognize musical notes. There's good pain, there's bad pain, there's red pain, there's blue pain, and understanding those is actually very important from a rehab perspective, because some pain in exercise is inevitable and some pain in rehab is going to happen and is a good thing.
We have just a few moments left, but in the course of writing this book, you listened to a lot of amazing personal stories about how Bikram yoga had changed people's lives, how it helped them recover from terrible injuries or from cancer, how it helped them overcome addictions to heroin and methadone. Is this all placebo effect? And might they have accomplished the same things if they had devoted themselves to any of a number of different disciplines that forced them to get themselves back into order, like running or just going to a gym or attending religious practices?
Well, that's definitely something I posit in the book. I don't think I call it the placebo effect. I think that the yoga taps into a lot of the same things that the placebo effect does. Absolutely, though, I do not think that there's anything particularly magical about the Bikram sequence. I think it taps into something that you can get in many different disciplines.
So how long did you stay and when did you leave?
I still practice. I'll practice 1 to 2 times a week.
Bikram.
Bikram, absolutely. I think it's a wonderful part of a balance workout. I don't think that indulging it to the degree I did for the book is necessarily something I want to do. But again, it's like going on a 2-week trek up Kilimanjaro. Do you want to do that for your whole life? No. Do you think you get a lot of value out of doing that for the 2 weeks? Absolutely.
How well did you do in the competitions?
I didn't win, didn't lose. The competitions, I have to say, are not about compete. They're about exhibiting. They're about demonstrating. And they're about sharing the practice. It's really about redefining competition in terms of doing your best, not the opponent's worst. So it's not about kneecapping your opponent. It's not Tanya Harding. It's about sharing. It's a yoga competition. It's friendly competition. People hug everyone before and after they get on stage.
Hellbent, Obsession, Pain, and the Search for Something Like Transcendence in Competitive Yoga is published by St. Martin's Press. My great thanks to Benjamin Lorr, L-O-R-R, for being on our show today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.